From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, New Orleans.
Yay!
Every franchise has a spinoff in New Orleans.
And
your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour is no exception. You have no idea how early it is here in Los Angeles. For some strange reason, Dean Haglund, there's only 2 hours difference between us now, and it's harder
right.
for me.
Yeah, and me. Don't kid yourself. Holy crap.
I am Phil Lairness, your friend in podcasting. Really, podcast royalty, and
yes.
dare I say, podcast legend.
Dare you say it?
Why are you in New Orleans?
Well, I mean, meeting up with friends. And, of course, family. Family's here, too.
Really?
Who
all from the family's there?
Well, from Patty's side. Her brother came down and all that.
Oh, sure. So, okay. Great.
Yeah, because that was closer on the East Coast. And so it's been a chance to catch up with everybody from around the world that will never come to Australia. So...
because it's the inoculations, it's the quarantine, it's the quarantine that we have to go through that just
That's right.
makes it seem we heard what it was for Mila and Akasha, and quite honestly, we're not gonna put up with that, Dean Haglund.
yeah, no, we're not. So, So anyway, we're here. And,
well,
give
my best to Bill. Give my best to Bill.
Yeah.
What have I heard though from you? And the answer to that is darn near nothing until now,
yeah.
when you're going to reveal more about some super secret performance, some super secret creative exercise going on.
Yes,
in the Bayou,
well,
in the Big Easy,
in the exactly.
Bean Town, if I'm not mistaken, Sin City. I don't know.
As you may or may not have recalled, I did a movie in Baton Rouge called Asylum, which in fact was another movie with Stephen Ray that was horribly botched that then we were called in to save by turning it into a comedy, which then made everyone angry across the board. Anyone who thought it might have been a good horror movie was angry at the comedy bits. And anyone who thought maybe it might have been funny were very angry that it was some horror bits in it.
So that it was not funny. Maybe that you'd thrown the comedy bits together by the seat yeah. of your pants.
Right. So
maybe. I'm just saying, I don't know.
Yeah. Anywho, one of the actors in that one has a small theater here in New Orleans, and the plan is that there'll be a top secret improv show with improv legend Natalie Haverstock, Miss Balooniverse herself, and I getting up on stage perhaps this very evening if it all works out.
I don't know. You've couched it all in so many conditionalities, if
yes.
that's a word usement that I may structure.
Well, it's surprising how fast plans break down here in New Orleans. What you think is going to be a lovely dinner and maybe a few drinks afterwards turns into a, how is it 3 a.m. all of a sudden? And that happened. That I'm not going to lie to you. There was 3 a.m. on my phone telling me what time it was here. And everybody's still up, so...
But I don't understand. So there might be this top secret performance with you and Miss Balooniverse, which would be technically last night. But
right.
So you would think by now we would know. But how will you get an audience into that if it may happen, it may not?
Well, there's already an audience there. It's like a comedy club. They have a variety of, it's a small theater that already does improv shows there, as far as I understand, so that we would go on afterwards and do like a half an hour of hilarious improv comedy from the old days. Two veterans getting on stage. You know how it is.
I sure do, Dean Haglund. I sure do. Now, I want to go back just a minute to this this asylum thing, because this is something that has always bothered a few
the
of
planet.
Us. No, it's bothered a few of us. A scant few, but the fury or the confusion that we have about it is really that... That I'm exhausted. Anyway,
I read the fury. I read
No. But it's there's a very small percentage of us that are bothered by something very arcane. Why the hell doesn't it show up for you on IMDb?
I think all of us who did the comedy on it.
Yeah.
Basically. Requested and get scrubbed, perhaps. But because I don't think there was an official production schedule. You know how IMDb listed. They actually put down from the dailies, you know, production managers.
Yeah, some initial cast list. Some cast list was submitted, and that's what's on IMDb, along with all the film's release dates and everything.
Right.
But the comedy cast, it's unbilled, which is fascinating to me. Fascinating being a strong word, but at this early in the morning, honestly, just staring at my cat making sculptures in her litter box was kind of interesting. So this is fascinating, and that is, you know, you can't keep a cameo, a celebrity cameo, secret. Why this is the first one to come off the top of my head, who knows? But when they made that 21 Jump Street movie with Channing Tatum and oh my goodness, Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill. Yeah.
I went into it knowing that Johnny Depp and Richard Grieco were in that thing. Because IMDb had... and they're even described on the IMDb list, uncredited cameo. Well, no, not apparently, because you just listed them. So there's no way, if you go to IMDb and use it as a resource, as you know that I do, that secrets can be kept. So somehow, Asylum and you have managed to pull off the trick that all these big budget films have not been able to.
Well, okay, so I would think the big budget films with the celebrity cameo is always a marketing tool to some degree. Whether you're keeping it secret, it's the Easter egg, it's the underground chatter. So eventually that's going to get to IMDb because they want to be on top of it. This was not a delightful marketing tool at all. It was merely a way producers were just trying to polish a turd. And,
I mean, Rice Girl, that's on there with a production with a production date of 2014. How'd they get that date changed? Oh my goodness! Someone was asking me last night, can we change the date of Lady Killers, because we technically finished it at the end of 2015, so that's the copyright date we put on it. But we're still mastering it, and it hasn't premiered. So they're saying, well, why don't you make it a 2016 date? And I was saying, well, I don't know if you can change that stuff on IMDb. Well, again, apparently you can, because Rice Girls, a 2014 vehicle for Dean Haglund.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And that was available on VHS, right, for a long time. Anyway, who cares? All right, enough of that unpleasantness. Tell me about the trip. Tell me about the excitement. What do you have to share?
Holy smokes. Excitement? The trip? Trip was painless, remarkably. Remarkably quick, caught up on some of my movie watching, and then
highs and lows. Yeah. Give me some highs and lows of the movie watching.
Let's see. Finally saw that Spectre, that James Bond Spectre thing.
I watched that again this week, actually.
Yeah, and what did you think of it again?
Well, I you know, there's some things in it that I thought they did well. Though I suddenly realized in a second viewing again, there's another rape scene for Bond, which, as you know, disturbs me. You know, there were some things they did well. Oh, man, the opening master shot using the Birdman technique.
Something?
Of course, that's fantastic. Bringing, you know, some of the scenes involving Spectre, terrific. I like the idea that there's this overarching organization that's been authoring everything that's gone on through all the movies. Love that. Yeah. Love. I, right now, in fact, it occurred to me this idea of Spectre has probably more appeal in contemporary life than it did back in the 60s. When they decided that they didn't want to alienate certain audiences around the globe by making the Russians be the Cold War villains, so they created this organization that would pit the Russians against the Americans constantly, right?
Right.
But
right.
Now, when so much of the threat apparently are these, you know, these terrorist cells in different parts of the world, kind of an interesting fictional avenue to explore, that there is one umbrella organization financing all of them. And so I thought that was cool. On the other hand, their need to turn James Bond into some sort of graphic novel superhero where everything is born out of his own personal biography.
Right.
Annoys me no end. I mean, because it's given such short shrift, if you want to say that Ernst Stavro Blofeld owes his origins to Bond's origin stories back from when they were boys, and here we are again with the killing of Bruce Wayne's parents, James Bond's parents, then you need to set that up gradually over several movies so that it's more than just an expositional payoff.
Yeah, absolutely. Because here again, the idea of even the name James Bond, when Ian Fleming wrote it, it was the idea that the most boring guy in the world is in a spy organization, MI5 or whatever, and these things happen to him. It happens to around a guy who's basically a journeyman spy. You know, he's James Bond. He thought that's a boring name. The guy's boring, but all of this glamour and excitement happens around him. To give him a personal backstory is to then sort of negate Ian Fleming's original idea of the whole thing in the first place.
Yeah, they also, you know, most of that was a mistake that they made in the last film, so there's no undoing that. There's no unringing that bell. But again, to say, to have this whole thing play out with, look, only two things survived the fire at Skyfall. One is the transfer of guardianship and this burnt photo that will become, lo and behold, a recurring prop throughout the movie. You know, it was enough to have this be a personal mission where Bond would go dark, where he would violate the orders of his supervisors, his immediate supervisors, that he nevertheless has a certain amount of respect for, because this video message is delivered to him in the wake of the previous M's death. It's enough of a personal mission for Bond to realize, I failed this woman in life, I'm not going to fail her in death, and therefore I'm going to do what it happens. You didn't have to tie in this personal story. And then there's the big problem, and I talked about this a lot on the show. Christoph Waltz is a marvelous actor. He's a marvelous actor in many different languages. He is a terrible villain. He is he's played villain in the Green Hornet movie. Terrible. People say, oh, but he was so scary in, for example, Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. You know why? Yeah. Because he didn't play it as a villain. He played it as a banal functionary. And that's what made it so terrifying.
Right. And you know the Nazi, you know, it comes with the baggage of being a Nazi in a movie, in a World War II movie. So all of that terror is already implied.
And it's all the more terrifying because it's revealed and expressed, like I said, through this banal, charming conversation. know, and whereas as character of Blofeld, you know, it was said a long time ago by people much smarter than me that Bond films live or die on the charisma of the villains. They need to exceed that of Bond himself. And when the movies don't work, it's because often they failed in that casting. So great actor Christoph Waltz miscast. So any true lowlights in your viewing on the plane before we get to our voluminous stack of topics we must cover in what's left of this show?
No, I thought my lowlight was going to be Creed. I know you love this.
Yeah.
Stallone vehicle. I thought it was going to be tired, and I thought you were just giving it too much credit. But in fact, it's pretty fantastic.
It is pretty fantastic. They breathe life back into it, and I would imagine on the on the plane, it's even better because this movie was shot almost entirely in close-up.
Yeah, exactly. And I got to say, the first fight with Creed and whatever the other boxer was,
the one in a
wraparound Steadicam.
Yeah.
I thought that was way more effective than the second fight and, you know, doing it back to the way Scorsese shot Raging Bull with, you know, flash and punches and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I thought that first fight sequence was so well choreographed and got you into that ring so much more effectively than any other boxing movie I've seen lately.
Ryan Coogler, this filmmaker who did Fruitvale Station, he thought all this through, didn't he? I mean, it would have been, I don't know how long ago they came up with this idea, but clearly this is someone who grew up a fan of the movies. And he had it all worked out, not just character. And honestly, that would have been enough to have a worthwhile character to explore and to draw the story out of that character. That's enough. But he really did work out how he was going to shoot all the signature scenes.
Yeah, it was really amazing. So two highlights there, no real lowlights.
Fantastic. Well, let's do this. It's a little something we haven't done in a while. It's called the Live Event of the Week.
Yay!
The Chilpack Hollywood Live Event of the Week.
I thought that's what I said, Garrett Watley. I was back down at the jewel of Orange County Theater. Really, one of the jewels of Southern California Theater now in its 52nd year. They said it wouldn't last. South Coast Repertory. For a world premiere of Julia Cho's new play, her fourth commission by South Coast Rep, a vehicle for the fabulously talented Sandra Oh, called Office Hour. And this play does what really I have yet to see any play or movie do effectively at this point. If there have been some, I'm sure I will hear about them from our angry listeners, but none are coming to mind, and none have come to mind since watching this, and it deals with the concept of a school shooter. Now, I know that there was a movie we need to talk about, Kevin, and that's a movie I loved, a brilliant movie, important movie, but it showed it from the parents' point of view. And the title of this movie, Office Hour, is literally an hour of this play, of this 90-minute play, a little less than 90 maybe, is set during an office hour where an adjunct professor tries to reach a non-communicative, moody, sad, almost invisible student who's expressing nothing but hostility and violence and rage through their creative writing assignments, and who has been reported by every other teacher that's had him as a potential shooting threat at this small university. And so it explores this topic, and this play is funny, this play is inventive, it's, dare I say, important. It is so moving, in fact, that here on opening night, during the curtain call, Sandra Oh and one of her co-stars are actually sobbing during the curtain call, not because they're so overwhelmed by the reaction of the audience, though that was powerful, but because of this emotional journey that they've just taken during the play itself. Like, they're spent. Wow. You know, they're raw, open nerves at the end of this. And the young man who plays the potential shooter, Dean, I mean, this was a case of love at first sight for me. His name's Raymond Lee. I'm not sure. I'm going to guess he's in his 20s. This guy is such the real deal. I'd heard about him because he's the lead in another play that debuted at South Coast Rep, then moved to the Pasadena Playhouse, and will now be going to Broadway, called Viet Gone. And I'd heard raves about his work. Again, actor in his 20s. Apparently, at the end of Viet Gone, he plays an elderly Vietnamese man. And when you see him as this elderly man, it is so authentic and believable. You want to go back and watch the whole play again to just really make sure that that young guy you saw through all of it really is a young guy. Because it's so hard to believe that somebody could so authentically be the old man at the end. Anyway, this young man, I just can't say enough. It was a breathtaking performance, and I even found myself saying to him what I rarely say to him. I never even used this before as a pickup line, Dean Haglund. I went up to him and I said, "My name's Phil Larenas. I make movies. I want you in them."
Wow. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
That's
never,
how good he is.
Never, ever, kids, this should be underscored, never, ever used that as a pickup line.
Yeah, I agree.
Until the other night at South Coast Rep.
And what's his background? Where do we know he's from?
I don't know. He's won a bunch of film festival awards for a movie that he starred in not too long ago, you know, in indie. But I don't know. I really don't know his background yet. I haven't researched it. But I will, and I'll find out more.
Yeah.
But this was just the other night, and it reminded me of a story that I'd been meaning to share with you, because you know, gun issues of gun control and mental health are things we talk about from time to time. Unfortunately, all too often, and knock on wood, we won't have to again in the near future. But I've been mentoring a high school student at the Kew Forest School in New York. And I was introduced to this student initially by one of our listeners, Takako Nagumo, who works there at the United Nations. I've mentioned her before. She's written us before. And anyway, she knew that this student was working on a film, on a dark comedy satire, as his thesis project as a senior. And they really were trying to find someone to mentor this young man through the process of developing his script and pre-production and production, etc. Anyway, the shooting took place. The shooting. That's such the bad choice of words in the wake
of
this topic.
Such a bad choice of
But you can't really say filming anymore because there's not filming. There's no film. But anyway, the principal photography of this thesis film took place last week. But a challenge that this young filmmaker faced, the premise is about three disaffected youths who decide to shoot up their entire school to express their frustration, their rage, you know, by shooting up an entire school, and they plan it, you know, to the nth degree. And one thing they didn't do was none of them bothered to open the email that said because of an in-service day, class was canceled for that particular day. So they show up on a school on a day when no one's there. And it is this dark comedy. The script has some real interesting merit to it. And it is ballsy exploring this topic through a dark comedy. Don't kid yourself. And doing it in a very thoughtful way. But this is something that you could only expect to find in a dark comedy. And that is, I get a frantic phone call and message from this young man, because Philip Selmo is his name, because he is unable to obtain any realistic prop guns. The laws have changed in New York to such a degree that it is almost impossible for productions to obtain realistic looking prop firearms. And and in other words, let me draw this conclusion for you. It's easier to get real guns in New York than authentic looking fake ones.
Wow. What?
Yeah. Why? I mean, almost as if, you know, the police were just tired of shooting kids with toy guns. Right. We should only be shooting people with real guns. So let's get rid of the toy guns. That'll solve the problem, won't it? Right? Who's with us?
Right. Yeah, because anybody with a gun, therefore, is a real gun. Therefore, any gun you see.
Even the prop. Apparently, the prop houses that would carry realistic firearms for Broadway productions are no longer leasing them or whatever.
Even the compressed air ones that we used on Lady Killers?
Yeah. They're very, very difficult, outlawed, all of this. So I finally was able to... first, I worked out a what I thought was a pretty brilliant worst-case scenario. And so brilliant, in fact, if I may pat myself on the back, that it left me hoping that I wasn't able to find an alternative so that this would have to be what was used. But ultimately, I was able to find through a military, a former military dealer, guns that are realistic that are used in exercises.
Ah, interesting.
And, but the young filmmaker opted to go with my first idea instead, which was get the most artificial-looking guns imaginable, have the actors play them for real.
Right.
You know, look, when we're in the theater, right, how much will we suspend our disbelief? We don't need sets. We don't need props. We will suspend
That's right.
all disbelief if what is being expressed and embodied by the actors is compelling and authentic. We'll do a lot of the work for us. And so I said, use the phoniest imaginable.
Right.
Let that be the part of the joke, but that obviously the stakes are incredibly high. And when a gun is pointed on someone, they are terrified of it. The terror has to be real, right? You can't be winking. And
right.
then in this speech at the end that's given, when the boys say, okay, maybe this was for the best. You know, we can regroup and plan this for another day. After all, I do have AP tests coming up, and I did study a lot, and it would be a shame to let those studies go to waste. While they're having that conversation at the end of the film, one of the guys could say, besides which, it does give us more time to get more realistic-looking firearms. And have just break the fourth wall at the end of the movie, because if there are any viewers who have been sitting back going, well, I just never was able to buy the guns, you know,
right.
then, and that's how they would sound, then then this, you get to tweak them on the way out the
right.
door, which I thought was fun. And he ended up liking that more ultimately than using the realistic looking firearms. So I like that he took a bold premise and just decided to go all the way bold with it. But I thought that was fascinating, that it's almost impossible to get these realistic looking prop firearms.
Wow, that is fascinating. I am shocked.
Well, thank you, Dean Haglund. Hey, letter from a loyal listener.
Oh, yay, we like letters.
Phil, here's a link to a radio interview with my friend and Dean's friend, Jan Derbyshire. Derbyshire?
Yay, Jan Derbyshire, yep.
Roundhouse, this is on roundhouseradio.com. Roundhouseradio.com. People can look it up and search on demand the name Jan Derbyshire. In it, she talks about her own experience with mental illness, institutions, health professionals, being a parent, and how she manages her life. I think you'll find it quite interesting. Jan was the person who introduced me to Dean. She is one of the strongest and funniest people I know. Anyway, hope you get a chance to listen to it. So you remember quite well this Jan Derbyshire.
Absolutely. Jan and I improvised together at length, and we wrote together. She's quite a brilliant Canadian playwright. writing Maharani and the Maple Leaf as their first breakout hit, starring Veena Sood back in the 90s, and then went off to continue her work in Toronto and at Theatre Passmurai, I believe, which is a big theatre company in up over on the East Coast of Canada. And I'm just searching now for Roundhouse Radio, and there it is. Huh. I'm going to listen to that.
Well, that's outstanding. The letter, whatever, concludes, by the way, thanks for the unsolicited ad a couple of weeks ago. Much appreciated. And I would love to have you guys record an episode in my store. Stephen D. Fowler and the Smokin' All-Stars Booksmith Quality Used Books. They're
and of course,
on Baker Street, on Baker Street in Nelson, British Columbia.
See, Stephen and I and Jan Derbyshire did a fringe show called The Comedy of Oedipus, called You Put Your Eye Out. See that? Because Oedipus stabbed his eyes.
I got it. That's one by one he stabbed them out, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. So fond memories all around.
Why don't we? I just was thinking this. I was just spitballing. Why don't we make a Booksmith fine used books there? Quality, excuse me, Booksmith quality used books, the official sponsor of what we're reading.
Hey.
What are you reading, Dean Haglund?
Well, I'll tell you, I stayed at a friend's house in Melbourne during the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and packed on his voluminous bookshelves was a biography of Peter Sellers.
Ooh.
That I'd never seen before.
Now, the comedic actor, not the brilliant theatrical director.
The comedic actor, not the, yes.
Okay.
Inspector Clouseau being there, the whole thing. So I'm in the middle of his early days when he was a jazz drummer, of all things, during the war. And performed at all the, what was the British version of the USO. So,
and fascinating. How often I hear comedy, you know, referred to or compared to jazz.
Yeah,
the timing of it.
It's really quite amazing, actually. And it's his early rise to fame coming from being drummer and funny man. That's how he was presented, actually. So. It's kind of neat that he's like, oh, yeah, wouldn't you get your comedy timing from being a jazz drummer and then being a funny man in between songs kind of thing.
You know, there was a time when you were drummer and funny man.
I was. Now I'm neither.
Of course, you were a punk rock drummer, not quite the same exploratory riffs that a jazz musician might make, not the same kind of delving, which is why most of your jokes involve set up. Fuck you! That would be...
Yeah, every one of my punchlines is some experience.
Go to hell! All right.
See you in hell. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is the influence of the early days, for sure.
Well, that's exciting. Now, I have been reading the first book. I found this, you know, I've been going and helping out my family, and I found this when I was clearing out, you know, they've got just a treasure trove of books, voracious readers, which you do when you're basically recovering from things. There's nothing to do but lay around and read, right? And so they've just got stacks and stacks and stacks of books, and one of the ones that I found, oddly enough, was a autographed hardbound copy of the first novel from Mark Frost. Mark Frost, still probably most famous, now he's quite famous as a novelist, but co-created Twin Peaks with David Lynch. And it's an Arthur Conan Doyle adventure about the writer of Sherlock Holmes called The List of Seven, and about Doyle writing a manuscript that borrows heavily from... We are so overcome by sirens. They're rushing to the ninth ward. Let it not be said that the Bush administration is not responsive to the needs of the citizens in the ninth ward. They're only getting there now, though.
They get carried on. They went down the street.
But it's about Doyle submitting a manuscript that borrowed heavily, dare we say stole, from the writings of Madame Blavatsky, one of the most famous figures in the Theosophist movement. Doyle getting into some otherworldly hot water as a result of this plagiarism.
Oh, and wait a sec. It's signed, a signed first edition.
That's the part of all this that was of interest to you. Yeah, it's a signed first edition by Mark Frost. I don't know how.
Oh,
my mom. My mom used to be very friendly with some book dealers. Not that we are not. I mean, what we're reading brought to you by Booksmith Quality Used Books. But she used to always get autographed. When books came out that were interesting, she'd always manage to get them autographed by the authors. These book dealers would send them to her. So I don't know.
Wow. This was a gift to you?
I found while I've been taking care of them and cleaning out different parts of the warehouse at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark that is where they live.
Wow. Well, this seems right up your alley. I mean, holy smokes. I can't believe you haven't found it till now.
Yeah. But they find us, Dean. We don't find the books. The books find us. And it's, you know where they find us? They find us at Booksmith Quality Used Books, 338 Baker Street, Nelson, British Columbia. I can't believe this got deleted from my notes, but we have to cover this. We've got such a long email from a listener coming up that I wanted to get to because I knew you'd enjoy the hell out of it. But we have a very sad celebrity death to get to, a life to remember, one of those lives that reminds you just how little you've accomplished in your own. Anyway, Garrett Watley, take it away.
Celebrity deaths.
Dan Ireland died at a very young age of 57. That's a very young age. But three different careers this guy had, and an enormous legacy he leaves behind in all three, really. Boy Wonder, Wunderkind, prodigious child prodigy who co-founds the Seattle International Film Festival at, I believe, age 17.
Wow.
Yeah. He's originally from Vancouver. You've heard of that. And co-founded with Daryl MacDonald Seattle International Film Festival in 75. And he would run it for the next 11 years. Of course, it's still going strong, one of the most important film festivals in the world. And during the period that he ran it, some of the films that had their world premieres at the festival, so that he helped discover, again, a teenager, by the way, when he starts this, a little movie called Blood Simple that launches the career of the Coen brothers.
Wow.
How about a movie that every other festival passed on, that every distributor passed on multiple times before it ultimately went on to be nominated for many Oscars, Richard Rush's The Stuntman.
Wow. That had its premiere in Seattle?
Yeah. George Miller's The Road Warrior, Paul Verhoeven's Soldier of Orange. He was awarded, as a matter of fact, at one point, the Golden Calf Award in 1983. So he's at the ripe old age of 25, and he's winning this award for his contribution to advancing the cause of Dutch cinema here in the United States. Just amazing. Like, that alone is a legacy, right? For someone who loves films. But in 1986, at a time when I'm escaping Cupertino, California by hot air balloon, one of the lucky ones, while the wall was being built, he's leaving the Seattle International Film Festival to come to Los Angeles. Again, so this is what, 11 years later, so he's now 28 years old.
Right.
And he becomes the head of acquisition for Vestron Pictures. Now, this company does not exist anymore. But in the 80s, boy, they were doing interesting work under his leadership. Here's some of the films that they acquired, that he spearheaded. John Huston's final film, The Dead, which would go on to Oscar nominations. Ken Russell's Salome's Last Dance and Lair of the White Worm and The Rainbow. Terry Jones' Personal Services. Earth Girls Are Easy.
Wow.
And the Oscar-nominated Anna. So he's doing this, again, late 20s, as an acquisitions executive. But, you know, having made his mark in that, and having done the Seattle International Film Festival, one needs new challenges. So here, still in his 30s, he leaves Vestron, goes into film production, producing films for Ken Russell, produced Ken Russell's Whore, and then made the transition into directing. His debut film being The Whole Wide World. Remember that? It was a biopic about the Conan the Barbarian creator, Robert Howard, starring Vincent D'Onofrio and Renee Zellweger.
Yeah.
It was nominated for the Dramatic Grand Prize at the 1996 Sundance Film Festival. Now, this would be, to me, the legacy of his that he leaves behind as a filmmaker, is how many actors' careers he either started, at least where film work is concerned, or certainly furthered. He gave Vincent D'Onofrio some of his most interesting lead roles, but he also is responsible for discovering Renee Zellweger. She played the lead in that, and that's her first film role.
Wow, I thought, you know, she came to fame based on her and Tom Cruise and...
Well, Jerry Maguire. Probably came to fame, but her first film role, the reason she gets cast in Jerry Maguire is because she's done a film... played the lead in The Whole Wide World.
Look at that.
This continued up until very recently when he gives the first film role, again, a lead role. How about that? Your first film role is a lead.
Yeah.
The first film role to Jessica Chastain. So much as you want to credit Phil Lernis, and you do, with discovering Jessica Chastain, with being one of the first to celebrate her on the very influential podcast, Chilpack Hollywood Hour,
yes.
Dan Ireland gives her her first film role in 2008's Jolene. In fact, it was Jessica Chastain who broke the news of Dan Ireland's death on her Twitter account.
I got to start following her.
To find out who's dead, because she's really plugged in there. Anyway, so this is a man, 57, so young, and yet, I said, boy, I got a lot this of catching up to do.
Absolutely. Now, do we know how?
Absolutely. Thanks for that. Do we know? No, cause of death has not been released.
Okay. Right. Well,
exhaustion, maybe. Maybe exhaustion from having accomplished so much. I can only imagine that cure for cancer was almost completed, that he had been
working
on. Anyway, yeah, Dan Ireland, many people very sad about this. I mean, this is, you can't go to a festival website right now and not see reminiscences about Dan Ireland. So Dan Ireland, age 57. Let's read this email, if we can get through all of it, and discuss what we have time to discuss. Dear Phil and Dean, greetings from the unrealized half-life of baked on, caked on, stuck on, slightly greasy solar atoms pummeling the greater metro area of Phoenix, Arizona. The preceding sentence makes no sense, which I suppose bodes ill for the rest of this email, but I will press on because it's my Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And don't you want to know how that works? With listeners like myself, probably not. No, yes, we do. That's one of the reasons we say, is it not, Dean, that it is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Please write us, by the way, as these people have done, at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Back to the email. As usual, I'm at least a couple episodes behind, for which I apologize. I'm just not in a position to listen to as many episodes as are available in the time I have allotted. That said, in a recent episode, several things were touched on that piqued my interest, and I wanted to respond. The mention of the Ghostbusters, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, and Hail Caesar brought to my mind something I had heard on a podcast, in parentheses, not Chill Pack Hollywood, several times.
What?
The hosts would state with regularity that Hollywood knows how to make a good trailer. This is a statement with which I vehemently disagree, if for no other reason than I believe I have had to learn how to read them in self-defense. When I was much younger, working a minimum wage part-time job and attending college paid for by said job, I would have summer sessions free with a couple of days off a week based on my college schedule. Being an insomniac and free of the confines of a relationship, I would go to my local video store and rent 5 to 10 movies to watch on my off days. It was cheaper than going to a theater to watch them, and I could build up a bank of film experience to be somewhat conversant with pop culture. It suited my life at the time, but I did begin to realize a few things. One was that I simply could not trust previews. Or rather, I could trust them to try and sell me a movie regardless of the movie's quality. Now, that would be a way of saying, would it not, that Hollywood knows how to make a good trailer. Because the bottom line is the bottom line. If the trailer got butts into seats, then they're going to give credit to the trailer, right?
Right.
Even though, as we've talked about before, a misleading trailer may lead to bad word of mouth for a movie if those butts in those seats didn't get the movie they were promised.
Right.
They may have been given a good movie, may have been given a better movie, but if it's not what they thought they were buying into, they might be unhappy and therefore bad word of mouth. But in an industry that ever increasingly relies on first weekend and first week box office revenue, maybe the powers that be don't care about that so much.
Right. I know. You sacrifice it. You're throwing the movie under the bus for the sake of the movie that's under the bus.
Yeah.
Right? He carries on.
Yeah. Oh, please. Up until I actually saw the new Ghostbusters preview, I'd been hopeful it would be something worth seeing. Having now seen the spot on YouTube, I'm doubtful. Doubtful is the kindest word I have ever heard in reference to having the YouTube equivalent of a bucket of hot urine poured over your head that is the Ghostbusters trailer.
But
he's doubtful. The preview tries to give a sense of homage to the original, but it appears that rather than shooting for that wry Ramis Murray Aykroydian humor with a few physical gags, it's big on more Sandler Farrellian boy man humor, substituting Y chromosomes for X and adding a lot more gags. What's more, assuming some of the gags in the preview were meant as big laughs, it's not funny, and it doesn't look fun either. Of course, that's how it looked to me. I'm putting that one in the wait until it's out on cable list, and I don't have cable. That's funny. Then there's Batman v. Superman, Dawn of Justice. There were a number of previews for this. I'm thankful for that, because if they'd stuck with the teaser preview, I might actually have gone to see this in theaters. To refresh, the teaser showed only Batman out for Superman's blood, ending with Batman asking, "Do you bleed?" All the imagery appeared to come from the Dark Knight Returns graphic novel, which many noted as a very positive sign. And there are lots of references to that in the film. But then we got the second preview. If you had read or heard storylines from the comics, that second trailer had you at once pleased and going, "What the fuck?" It looked like good Batman versus Superman conflict, especially with Lex Luthor acting as catalyst. Although, again, as I pointed out, you could already tell from the trailer that Jesse Eisenberg gave the all-time worst villain performance in the history of cinema.
Totally.
You could already tell that. And it turns out he's not Lex Luthor. He's Lex Luthor's son anyway. But then Doomsday shows up. Oh, and let's sprinkle in some Wonder Woman. Why not immediate red flags thrown? Too many players on the field. $400 million penalty. Script approval violation. Okay, so based on second trailer, the end of the movie could pretty much be guessed at. I've been spoiled on this by reviews, but I can't be upset because everything was telegraphed in the second preview and my suspicions were only confirmed. Have you heard mixed responses from reviewers and fans and friends and family? Truly, truly mixed. Mixed. I mean, because it did run the gamut from bad film to worst film ever.
I had one friend who enjoyed it, didn't know what all the why everybody was trashing it, but that was
no. As we talked about, it does not matter how shitty something is; there will always be people who like it, and God bless you for liking it. But also, as I pointed out, Americans eat shit, and some do it with great relish. So, and you need the relish to sometimes
to shoot that. See, yes, very good.
So. Anyway, with regard to Hail Caesar, I really want to see it. I've never been disappointed by a Coen Brothers film, which means they've got a good track record. And the preview immediately made me think in terms of films like Mel Brooks' To Be or Not to Be, Blazing Saddles, and Spaceballs, while at the same time thinking of Cleopatra, Samson and Delilah, and the Ten Commandments. The preview cries out, I am a satire. I am a satire. I mean, I'm a funny, inoffensive flick about the backlot in Hollywood. No, really, I mean it. Cough. This is a film I will support as soon as I can find a screening for it. I'll probably see it in theaters and buy a copy for my home library. I don't know really what the point of that one was. But anyway, moving away from films, I want to add some to the discussion of Bitcoin. I might save that for next week so that we can spend a few minutes talking about these trailers. Because this is one of our favorite topics.
It is one of our favorite topics because we talk about marketing all the time and because we say, yes, what is the function of a trailer? As you said, to sell the film, but to sell it to what the marketing thinks is its most salable aspects. And this takes into account all the test research and the marketing research and all that sort of thing. It's always a bit of, a shocker for me is that they always sell what I think is the least compelling aspects of the movie. So,
you know, this Batman versus Superman one is really interesting because the trailers were terrible. But, you know, all these people who said, well, you can't judge it in advance from the trailers. Honestly, this is where the line Hollywood knows how to make a good trailer comes into play to me, because you know with a superhero movie that you're not going to get something other than a superhero movie, right? This is not going to be Nightcrawler where they're marketing it as a psychological thriller because dark comedies are seen as box office poison and they don't know how to market dark comedies because how do you market tone, as we said? And that's something that Hollywood can't do. They can't do a trailer yet that really seems to capture tone. So they have to market, as you said, the elements. So they turn Nightcrawler into a psychological thriller. Lo and behold, they get $40 million in box office, but they don't get the awards traction that it probably deserved because they delivered a movie other than what was promised. A better movie, but a movie other than what was promised. And that actually made a lot of people angry.
But
in a case of Batman versus Superman, you're not going to get a movie other than what you're promised. And honestly, if those trailers are the best job that the trailer filmmakers can do with the material they've been given, you know that movie is dreadful. And part of the reason you know that is because trailer filmmakers are actually better at telling a story than Zack Snyder, who's the director of Batman versus Superman.
and have you seen that thing on YouTube where somebody has taken all of the trailers and all of the secret bonus released footage and made an 11-minute version of Batman versus Superman that basically has the entire story, the plot, and all the best action sequences all in this 11 minutes, that you don't have to waste your precious 120 minutes seeing the whole thing.
Well, I wish I'd known about that. Anyway, the other element of this, though, is you've spent $250 million making a film, and now you know, to try to cover your ass, you're spending $150 million more marketing this thing.
Yeah.
And so as we've said, you know, depending on the estimates that were given, this movie needed to make anywhere from $925 million to $1 billion at the global box office to ultimately break even. And up until a couple weeks ago, even with the box office plummeting for this thing to a record degree after its opening, which indicated how horrible the word of mouth was, it looked like this might just eke it out. It might come in just shy, but in ancillary markets, eventually it would break even. Even that right. felt like a bit of a failure, because you don't, you know, you don't introduce an entire DC cinematic universe and hope to break even off of it. But now it turns out, just a week later, it's much worse than anybody thought. It's going to end up at least 100 to 150 million shy of what it needed to break even.
Wow. And which is exactly what they spent on marketing.
Which is exactly what they spent on marketing. Exactly. So it makes you really, really scratch your head about the approach on this. I wanted to talk about a couple of trailers that everyone is seems to be talking about. One is a quite effective trailer for this Star Wars standalone movie. And by the way, speaking of Star Wars, it really does look like, as I said, that Alden Ehrenreich, who I champion so much from Hail Caesar, that he's going to be young Han Solo. If anyone can.
Wow.
Here's Star Wars Rogue One. Have you, or Rogue One, a Star Wars story, I guess, as the
right,
title officially
right.
is. Have you seen the trailer for this?
I've seen clips from the trailer, actually, but I haven't seen the official trailer, as it were, so...
I mean, it is an effective trailer. It is good, and it does seem to me to potentially return us to maybe a Star Wars that does have some mythology to it, unlike, you know, J.J. Abrams. And you got to love this cast. In addition to the leads of Felicity Jones and Diego Luna, I'm not sure there's ever been a cast like this in a Star Wars movie. I mean, the great Ben Mendelsohn, Donnie Yen, Forrest Whitaker, Mads Mikkelsen. How about Alan Tudyk, for crying out loud?
Holy smokes.
These are great actors. And I also do, as we said, we were talking about storylines that would have been more interesting involving, you know, stormtroopers for Star Wars. I kind of do love the idea of exploring this story of the spies who risked their lives to get the plans to the Death Star to the rebellion prior to the beginning of Star Wars. That actually is a pretty cool story to tell, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
So here I am, not excited, wishing that Star Wars would go away. How can we miss it if it won't go away? And yet, here I am going, this could be a good movie. And it's based on the trailer.
Wow. So are you now, what are you doing? What are you contradicting your...
No, I'm just saying, that's a very well-made trailer. That's a very, very well-made trailer.
Unless the movie is completely different than what the trailer promises.
But does that mean that it's not well made? I mean, again, it depends on, you know, what seat you're in, right? If you're in the seat of the paying audience, yeah, right. Then that might be a problem. But if you're in the one counting the money from that paying audience, you might not care. You're certainly never going to blame the trailer. Right?
Well, that's true.
You're going to blame the movie. Another trailer that's getting a lot of play that I hope is just an awful trailer is David Brent, Life on the Road.
Oh.
And this is a big screen feature following Ricky Gervais' most famous creation, David Brent from The Office. And, of course, he's revisited this character in The Office special, which was... the high point of any Office, American or British.
Right.
But this follows David Brent all these years later, and this trailer is all lowest common denominator in the name of trying to recapture that real discomfort. And it does. I felt uncomfortable watching it, but not uncomfortable on behalf of the character. Uncomfortable on behalf of Ricky Gervais.
Oh, that's
how dreadful this trailer was.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Well, gee whiz. I mean, what do you say? You say, are you hoping again the trailer has been cut incorrectly? Are you hoping that, I don't know. I'm not going to cast aspersions without seeing it, so I'm going to look that up.
All right.
And comment it on next week.
Meanwhile, you know, getting back to this idea of spending all this money on Batman versus Superman, when Warner Brothers knew, and word got out that they knew how bad this movie was, and they then had to deny that they were frantically setting up everything that they've now announced they had set up. Here's what you do when you have a good movie and you know you have a good movie. You do what the Marvel team has done with Captain America. What's it called? Civil War.
Civil War, yeah.
They showed it to critics a month before it opens. A month before it opens. You know why? They have a good movie. If a movie is good, that's how people are going to treat that movie. They're going to let people see it. Because reviews and word of mouth, though that might not kill a movie, those are always welcome when you know those are going to be good.
Right.
And then you don't have to hard sell a movie, which only makes you seem more desperate and puts you more in a financial hole. So that's an interesting counter case study. Just another way in which the Marvel Cinematic Universe is different than the DC Cinematic Universe. Real quick, lightning round. I will say in looking at some trailers, I found a couple of bits of news about movies that I am really looking forward to, one of which is about to go into production. And I hope this is going to be good. It's from Adam Rifkin. And it is the first big screen vehicle for Kiernan Shipka, who I don't think we've talked about, but she is the terrific young actress who played Dawn Draper's daughter Sally throughout the entire run of Mad Men.
Oh, right.
How great was this girl? How lucky were they to have cast that girl as a little girl and for her to grow into not just such a beautiful woman, but such a powerful actress?
Yeah, they're pretty amazing.
Anyway, she is cast, set to star opposite Burt Reynolds in a comedy, Dog Years. The story is centered on an aging former movie star, played by Reynolds, who's forced to face the reality that his glory days are far, far behind him when he's invited to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from a tiny East Coast film festival near where he grew up. Embarrassed by the low rent event, he bails on the award and forces the emotionally unstable girl assigned to be his driver, played by Kiernan Shipka, to take him on a soul-searching tour of the landmarks of his youth.
Ah.
Oh, man, that could be good. That could be good. Career capper for Burt Reynolds and a stepping stone to really launch Kiernan Shipka into adult roles. I mean, that could be really, really fun. And finally, great news for me. I've talked about this on and off over the last couple of years when it seemed like there was exciting developments and then they fell apart. But there's the possibility that once and for all, the final Orson Welles movie, The Other Side of the Wind, will get completed and will get distributed because now Netflix is negotiating to take charge of this.
Wow. Hooray.
And that would be exciting because, of course, legendarily, this film, when it was seen the one time, the one screening Wells was allowed to have before the Iranian government took over the negative and allegedly destroyed all of it, this was a masterpiece. So I certainly can't wait. Hopefully you found this episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour to be a masterpiece. You can find all of them from good to masterpiece at chillpackhollywood.com. You can follow us on Twitter.
Yep. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
You can like us on Facebook.
Yes. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
And we told you how to write us. So I think there's nothing else to say other than we're brought to you by Empire State Gas from farm to pump. We've got great gas. Thank you, Blog Talk Radio, for hosting us. Till next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Oh, and stop by the Los Angeles Breakfast Club to see Dean Haglund in person this Wednesday.
This Wednesday. So excited. It's going to be great. Launching my new book.
All right. See you then, Dean.
See you, man.
Belated spoiler alert.